This is the Alkazine Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hofland.
In this episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Steven Spellman. Dr. Spellman is Vice President and Senior Scientific Director at Be The Match and the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research. We talk about the outcomes of a study published in Blood Advances, the Journal of the American Society of Hematology, discussing the impact of cryopreservation of hematopoietic cell grafts on overall survival and other outcomes within 1 year after cell transplantation. Now, at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the National Marrow Donor Program mandated the cryopreservation of hematopoietic cell grafts because of patients and donor safety concerns. Cryopreservation was considered a method to eliminate the risk with the use of fresh donor products. One of the concerns was that as a result of the COVID pandemic, delivery of donor products after patient conditioning could not be guaranteed. This was, in part, caused by logistical complexities, including travel bans, flight delays, flight cancellations, rerouting of couriers, and things like closed borders. In addition, donors were at risk of being infected with COVID, which in turn resulted in last-minute cancellations of graft collection. To address the problem, the National Marrow Donor Program, together with several global donor registries, required the cryopreservation of most unrelated donor products during the first 6 months of the pandemic. But what was the impact of cryopreservation on patients receiving hematopoietic cell transplantation compared to the effects among patients receiving fresh donor products? Was there a difference in overall survival, in disease-free survival, or disease recurrence? Was there a risk in graft versus host disease? In today's episode of the Oncogene Brief, we talk about this and more. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief. The Oncogene Brief is developed in collaboration with our online journal Oncogene, where you can find additional information and the latest news about cancer diagnosis and treatment and cancer prevention. Support for the Oncogene Brief comes from the Oncology Directory at oncologydirectory.com and from listeners like you. For more information on how to support this program, visit our website Oncogene at oncogene.com. And if you are living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer to 66866, and we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology.
This is the Oncogene Brief. For the latest news about cancer and cancer treatment, visit our online journal, Oncogene, at www.oncogene.com.
On the phone with me is Dr. Steven Spellman. Dr. Spellman, Steve, welcome to the Oncogene Brief. You're the Vice President and Senior Scientific Director at Be The Match and the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research, right? Tell me a little bit more about yourself and about the organization you work for and what you're trying to do for patients that may be affected with cancer or hematological malignancies or other diseases.
Sure. Happy to answer that, Peter. And thank you for the invite and the opportunity to share some of our research today with the Oncogene audience. So, as you mentioned, I'm the Vice President of Research at the National Marrow Donor Program, or the NMDP. I'm also a Senior Scientific Director in the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research, which is a research collaboration between the NMDP and the Medical College of Wisconsin. So we have had a long-standing research collaboration that started in the early 2000s, where we have merged our research programs to capture data on patients proceeding to transplant, receiving either autologous or self-transplants, allogeneic, so transplants from donors, as well as cellular therapies and gene therapies. And so we have an active registry that has captured data on over 630,000 patients to date. We use that data to perform observational research studies, of which I'll be speaking today about that experience, and use that to help guide transplant practice, So mainly observational studies that are coming out of the research database, but we also have an active prospective research program facilitated through our, what we call our clinical research organization services, which manages early stage phase one, phase two trials. That's based in our Minneapolis office of the CIBMTR, as well as participate as part of the Coordinating Center for the Blood and Marrow Transplant Clinical Trials Network, which is an NIH-funded clinical trials program that supports mainly phase three trials in transplant and cellular therapy. So our goal here is to utilize these data resources to provide guidance on how transplant should be performed, cellular therapy should be performed, and offer evidence-based guidance for clinical practice.
That's a lot. Now, you've mentioned observational studies designed to help you guide transplant practice. To help our listeners understand the difference between observational studies and randomized controlled clinical studies, tell me a little bit about these differences and about these studies. What's the difference between them?
Yeah, so observational studies are where we are prospectively collecting observational clinical data on patients transplanted within the U.S. and selective international centers that choose to participate in the CIBMTR. We use standardized data collection instruments that capture information on donors, their patients, or the patients, the disease, the transplant procedure, and then outcomes post-transplant, capturing data at baseline, 100 days post-transplant, so everything that occurred from day zero to day 100, and then at 6 months, 1 year, and then subsequently yearly after that until either the patients choose to not participate in research anymore or pass away. So we do capture long-term longitudinal data on those patients. So where we can use the observational data is to evaluate things that probably isn't well-suited for a randomized clinical trial, such as HLA matching for transplantation. So the rule of thumb would be match to the best potential available donor. Unfortunately, not every patient has a fully matched donor available, but want to be able to offer those transplant procedures, the potentially curative therapy to those patients. So we'll capture that data and be able to review that retrospectively through observational research projects to understand the impact of various HLA mismatches and the influence that may have had on transplant outcomes to better inform, say, donor selection going forward, where that really wouldn't be appropriate to do in, say, a randomized trial, saying assigning people to a well-matched donor versus a mismatched donor in a randomized manner.
If you look at the outcomes of observational studies, the types of studies where researchers observe the effect of a risk factor, a diagnostic test, treatment, or other intervention without trying to change who is exposed to it, and this is different than, for example, a randomized clinical trial, you may be able to collect more in-depth and impactful data because these studies generally run longer, right?
In some ways, yes. I mean, you're not controlling for an intervention as you can on a clinical trial, but so you're better reviewing more of the overall practice that's been seen in the community. So more of a use of real world data to better understand the impacts of trends in transplant in treatment practices and the influence that has had over time. So being able to compare eras of treatments and different strategies for treatment and segregating even at center level to be able to evaluate how centers are actually performing. So lots of other opportunities to continue to mine observational databases.
So this goes more towards what the United States Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, requires for drug trials right now, what we call real-world data, right? When you develop the observational studies, the longer time, the more in-depth questioning, that all may help you to get a real picture of what I think, and you mentioned this, what is going on in the clinic and how you can actually adjust studies to treatment options for patients, right?
Potentially, yes. It could provide some of those insights that maybe aren't going to be apparent in a shorter follow-up on a clinical trial. So really looking at longer-term outcomes, potential longer-term risks, really benefit from the longer-term longitudinal follow-up that's done within observational studies. The other thing to note with our observational database is we do capture biological samples on a subset of the population, and so we can go back and review those as well and explore other factors that may not have been considered at the time of the transplant. So in the case of, say, HLA typing, looking at extended loci, a more precise depth of matching to see if that makes a difference in overall outcomes where that may not have been feasible at the time due to technical difficulties or even the limitations of the way that data was collected at the time of those transplants. So we can add to those databases as well, which is really, really useful for exploring new factors.
That's really interesting. It's actually very nice to be able to enrich that information. Let's take a break. This is the Oncogene Brief. If you're just joining us, in today's episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Spellman. Dr. Spellman is Vice President and Senior Scientific Director at BDMATCH and the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research. I'm Peter Hoffland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
The station that makes you feel good.
Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.Health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world and hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.Health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hoffland.
And welcome back. This is the Oncogene Brief. If you're just joining us, in today's episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Spellman. Now, let's switch gears a little bit and look at the study you've conducted. What comes to mind is that most people around us, and I think that involves the listeners as well, are very happy that the COVID-19 pandemic is to some extent over. And while COVID is expected to be with us for a long time, the actual pandemic, I hope that's true, though, is actually behind us. Having said that, the COVID pandemic has had a major impact on healthcare. How did the COVID pandemic impact your organization? And what is more important, how this pandemic impacted patients you're trying to help during the pandemic?
That's a great question. Well, it was a very substantial impact on our patient population. So the parent organization that I work for is the National Marrow Donor Program. We facilitate unrelated donor and related and cord blood transplants, handling all of the donor search and match, as well as the logistics for the distribution of those for the collection and distribution of those products. unrelated donor or allogeneic stem cell transplant is a very international business. About approximately half of all products cross an international border. And that's because the diaspora of the world has really been spread out across the globe. And so your donor may be anywhere in the world. And so we need to be able to harvest those cells from the donor where they happen to reside and get them to the patient who happens to need them. Obviously, the travel disruptions that occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic necessitated a complete change to the way that we were managing the collection and distribution of those products due to inconsistencies in travel schedules, major disruptions in ability to travel, and even restrictions on international border crossings during the pandemic. And so we had to work closely with the State Department to ensure that we could cross international borders, also set up a hub and spoke type of a transport system. All the vast majority of the products that we distribute are hand couriered by individuals. And so to be able to make handoffs at international borders to known individuals to actually ensure that we had point-to-point distribution and chain of custody of those products was a Herculean feat at the time. But the NMDP did amazing work during the pandemic to ensure that all patients in need would receive those products in a timely manner. And part of that goes to the research that we'll be discussing today, which was implementing a mandate to cryopreserve products. And the rationale for that being that if we were harvesting a product from a donor, ensuring that it would be received at the institution where the patient would be receiving their transplant or their infusion prior to initiating their conditioning therapy. So whether that's a reduced intensity conditioning strategy or a myeloablative conditioning strategy, those patients undergo pretty extreme levels of chemotherapy to prepare them to receive the graft. And it leaves them extremely neutropenic and susceptible to all sorts of opportunistic infections. The last thing that we would want to have happen is to not have a graft there ready to infuse at that time. So cryopreservation was mandated to ensure that those products were present prior to the patient initiating their preparative regimen to receive their graft. And that worked quite well. But we also wanted to understand the impacts that may have on the performance of those products, hence the research that was done in the study that we'll be discussing today.
So if I understand correctly, the moment that you have bone marrow available and there is a patient waiting for treatment, wherever that patient may be, there is only a limited time to act. The clock is ticking, right? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, in normal times, products are collected and infused within about a 48-hour window. So any disruption to that or prolonging of that window leads to the degradation of that stem cell product. We've published some studies in the past looking at kind of shelf stability of grafts. And once you hit about 48 to 72 hours, you really start to see a degradation in the cellular composition, as well as the potency of those products. So ensuring that a product could be harvested and processed in a way that it could be preserved within that first 48 hours of initial collection, then ensures that you would have a more robust product for infusion into the patient at their time of need. And so with all of the logistical issues and logistical issues with travel, but then also with even donor susceptibility to infection as well, which could lead to delays in harvest and being able to even collect that product or having to shift gears to a backup donor in the event that a donor tested positive for COVID-19 during their workup process. To have a bit of that time buffer to support the collection of the product, the preparation of it, and ensure that it was transported and available in a timely manner for the patient.
Now, the study, Clinical Impact of Cryopreservation of Allogeneic Hematopoietic Cell Grafts During the Onset of the COVID-19 Pandemic, was published earlier this year in Blood Advances, the Journal of the American Society of Hematology, and discusses the study results and impact of cryopreservation and how this affected patients, right? Now, you gave us a great introduction, but to start, what were the major questions that you wanted to have answered by this study? I do understand that one question you like to have answered was, of course, about cryopreservation and if this is an option in the process. But were there more questions? Were there other questions that you wanted to have answered?
That's a good place to start, because there have been studies that have been done in the past looking at the comparing of fresh to cryopreserved products in allogeneic transplant. There were three studies that were published kind of leading into the pandemic, all from the CIBMTR. One that looked at the use of cryopreserved grafts in the haploidentical setting. This was a study that was led by Mehdi Hamadani and showed that there was really no impact in this haploidentical setting using a post-transplant cyclophosphamide-based GVHD prophylaxis strategy. There didn't appear to be an impact on outcomes in patients receiving either fresh or cryopreserved grafts. So that's one example. Another study that was conducted looked in severe aplastic anemia and the use of bone marrow grafts. Now that was a study that was led by Dr. Mary Epen through the CIBMTR, and that showed that there was a substantial risk associated with use of cryopreserved grafts in that setting. So not recommended in the severe aplastic anemia setting. Another study that looked at a more diverse set of diseases and in a broader population really was a pre-pandemic evaluation. This was a study that was led by Jack Hsu from the Moffitt Cancer Center down in Florida and conducted through the Donor Health and Safety Working Committee of the CIBMTR. There, it was shown that there was an impact on overall survival considering the use of peripheral blood stem cell grafts. There didn't appear to be a difference with the use of bone marrow grafts, whether they were fresh or cryopreserved, for patients receiving transplants for hematological malignancies. In digging a bit deeper into the data, what we didn't capture all the time was the rationale for cryopreservation, since in normal pre-pandemic times, the default was always to prefer fresh grafts if they could be given. And that's not just for patient safety reasons, but also donor reasons. And in the unrelated donor setting, there's always concerns about final utilization of those products. So if they're being collected, cryopreserved, they may not be infused at the end of the day. And so just ensuring that each product is that's collected is being directed to the patient that's in need. But within that study, we did have some data for a subset where we were able to evaluate the rationale for cryopreservation. And in over 60% of those transplants, the delays and the need for cryopreservation was mainly due to issues associated with either disease progression, infection, or other patient-related factors that may be associated with a more severe disease state or other issues that really couldn't be well adjusted for within that analysis. And so that was a caveat and one of the limitations of that study. Now, moving into the pandemic, we had a unifying rationale for the use of cryopreservation for all allogeneic products. And the vast majority were cryopreserved during that time frame. So in the present study, what we did was we compared transplants that were performed in 2019, looking at the first six months of 2019 compared to the post-pandemic 2020, once the cryopreservation mandate went into effect. And so we're able to compare transplants that were performed in the setting of fresh grafts as the default and in the setting of cryopreserved grafts as the default, and compare and contrast those results. And so that was one of the main impetus for the present study, but then also to have that kind of level playing field. So we knew that all of those products were destined for cryopreservation. It was planned for at the center. They were being cryopreserved in that kind of critical window of the vast majority being cryopreserved in less than 48 hours of collection, with some that maybe traveled a bit farther, may over international borders or so, being a bit more delayed in that case. So there we were able to really kind of do more of an apples-to-apples comparison of a rationale for using either a fresh or a cryopreserved product, which was important to kind of level set the population in this case.
Let's take a short break, and then we're back with Dr. Stephen Spellman.
sarcoma. Odds are you've never heard that word before. For the 40 people diagnosed with sarcoma every day, it is a life-changing word because sarcoma is cancer. Through awareness, advocacy, and research, the Sarcoma Foundation of America is bringing hope to the families whose lives have been turned upside down by a cancer they had never heard of until diagnosis. Please join us in the fight to find the cure for sarcoma. For more information on the work of the Sarcoma Foundation of America, go to curesarcoma.org.
This is the Oncozine Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hofflin.
And welcome back. This is the Oncozine Brief. If you're just joining us, in today's episode of the Oncozine Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Spelman. I'm Peter Hofflin, and this is the Oncozine Brief. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the standard approach was using quote-unquote fresh bone marrow, fresh grafts, rather than cryopreserved, right? Now, due to logistical requirements impacted by COVID and a whole host of other reasons and circumstances, the standard procedure needed to be changed. You successfully, and kudos to that, were able to switch the way you were able to help patients in need. But then the most important question is, what impact did this have on patients? Because what I assume is that every doctor listening to the show wants to hear this. What is the patient impact? What were the outcomes, negative or positive? And were these outcomes practice changing? What can you tell us about that?
Sure. So I can walk through a bit of the results from the study. So what we did find in comparing fresh to cryopreserved was there was no impact on overall survival. There was also no impact on what we call GVHD-free relapse-free survival, non-relapse mortality, acute GVHD. So no major issue with overall survival. So that was really encouraging. That was an encouraging finding. However, we did see some negative impacts. And one was an increased risk of relapse in the use of cryopreserved grafts, as well as that associating with an increased risk of or a decreased disease-free survival. So, and that mainly due to relapse risk. We did see a slight delay in engraftment in using the cryopreserved grafts, but that equated to about a one to two day delay in neutrophil engraftment and a 1 to 2 day delay in platelet engraftment, which may not be clinically meaningful at the end of the day. We did see one positive signal, which was a little surprising to the study team, and that was a decreased risk of chronic GVHD in the use of cryopreserved grafts. It's not really clear what was driving that in the study, and that is a subject of future investigation that we will be evaluating currently in a graft versus host disease working committee study within the CIBMTR. And that those findings were also noted by a team at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, led by Kate Maurer. Dr. Kate Maurer observed that similar phenomena where they noted a decreased risk of chronic GVHD, and particularly in peripheral blood stem cell grafts, which in the past had been noted for an increased risk of chronic graft versus host disease in comparison to bone marrow grafts. So we do want to dig into that a little bit more, and so see what cellular factors may be manipulated by the cryopreservation that may be influencing that chronic GVHD reduction. It's good news, but then that also in putting that all in context, though, the increased risk of relapse and lower disease-free survival would push us to recommend fresh products where available, but then noting that cryopreserved products can be used when logistics do not permit use of fresh products.
Does the fact that this methodology, this option is available, does that mean that more patients can be treated or maybe are eligible for treatment?
Well, does it expand access to patients in need? Potentially, by being able to adjust the timing of collection. So let's say the only donor that's available is not able to donate on the timeline to be able to deliver a fresh product. The clinical team could decide to harvest ahead of time on the donor schedule to be able to facilitate a cryopreservation of that product and then infusion at the time a patient needs. So that can assist when there's limited donors available for a particular patient. So expanding access through that mechanism, but then also in the event that there are logistical problems that occur just in the moment. So a donor could be harvested in the process of being collected, and then a patient perhaps comes down with an infection that needs to be treated and they're not ready to proceed with their transplant immediately. Those cells could be cryopreserved and used at a later date. So there's opportunities to do that. Frankly, with centers being more familiar with the cryopreservation process, that hopefully having more standardized procedures for that and built into their workflows to be able to facilitate that when and if it does arise, may help with a broader access to transplant as well.
And that may not necessarily happen as a pre-planned strategy, right? But I assume that this can be very beneficial, even in a situation where, like you mentioned, the patient is not available. Maybe the patient comes down with something like the flu or something that would require you to delay a transplant. But if that happens, you still be able to harvest and get everything ready for the time when the patient is ready, right?
Yes, exactly. And the data that we have published does suggest that there is some impact on outcomes, but they are not huge in magnitude at the end of the day and doesn't compromise overall survival. The disease relapse risk increase definitely is a concern, especially in malignant disease where this is intended to be curative and eradicate the underlying disease. However, relapse does remain one of the main points of treatment failure for hematological malignancies receiving allogeneic transplant. And so that is an area of intense research at this point to best understand factors that can help control that disease. It doesn't appear that cryopreservation of a product is one of those. So that's one that we could potentially take off the table, but then to pursue other factors and ways that we could enrich those fresh products to better control disease in the future.
Well, you mentioned disease relapse. You mentioned that this may also happen when you use fresh grafts instead of cryopreserved. So what is the difference? If you look at the numbers, if you look at the available data, is such a disease relapse really caused by cryopreservation, or are there other underlying reasons why this may happen?
That's a good question. I mean, within these multivariate models that are used for evaluation of factor for adjustment of factors that are not your primary variable of interest, there can be limitations to those approaches. One concern that we had at the time was whether our populations were comparable between say 2019 and 2020, because in the event of the pandemic, patients that maybe had more stable disease and were less an urgent need for transplant may have had that therapy delayed to some degree. We tried to control for that by selecting for the types of diseases that were analyzed in the population, restricting to acute leukemias and myelodysplastic syndrome, as those require more urgent treatment as opposed to some other diseases that maybe could may manage through additional chemotherapy or other types of treatment to delay the need for transplant. But we controlled for as best as we could. Now, still seeing this slight increase in relapse due to what we were attributing to the cryopreservation process remains to be explored in more detail to better understand the underlying mechanisms that may have influenced that.
And that is part of what you're trying to do in upcoming studies, I assume.
Yes, we would like to look at that in more detail, as well as looking at longer-term outcomes as well. I mean, we were limited to looking at one-year outcomes just due to the timeliness of the data and wanting to get this into the literature as quickly as we could to offer guidance to the clinical teams that were performing these transplants. But then we do have an intent to extend the follow-up. So to look at longer term, 2, 3, 4 year outcomes in this population, as well as exploring in more detail that chronic GVHD association and potentially that relapse risk factor. So some of the things that we weren't able to evaluate was potentially the presence of measurable residual disease in some of the acute leukemia. So how deep was the remission for these patients that were proceeding to transplant was not evaluable in this cohort, just due to a lack of access to samples, as well as the testing required to assess that in a uniform manner in the population. So other things that could have confounded those results.
Let's take a break. This is the Oncogene Brief. If you're just joining us, in today's episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Spellman. I'm Peter Hovland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hovland.
And welcome back. In today's episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Spellman. Dr. Spellman is Vice President and Senior Scientific Director at Be The Match and the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research. I'm Peter Hovland, and this is the Oncogene Brief. So overall, if you look at what you've not been able to measure, and that is probably hypothetical, how might that change the acceptance of this approach? I mean, you hope, of course, that minimal residual disease is indeed minimal. But what might change if there are different findings, different outcomes?
So what may change from a use of cryopreservation standpoint if there were different findings? Well, let's just take a hypothetical then. So let's say there was a minimal residual disease or measurable residual disease at an extremely low level and say a TP53 mutation, which is associated with a very high risk of relapse post-transplant. What we don't understand within our populations was, were they balanced for, say, TP53 mutations within the 2019 cohort and the 2020 cohort? And of those, how deep was the remission in those particular patients? So there may have been some imbalance that could be associated with that higher risk of relapse. So if we were hypothesizing that higher risk malignancies were those that were being transplanted during the heart of the pandemic, when it was logistically difficult to perform those transplants, and there may be less tolerance for delay in the case of those patients, that could influence that increased risk of relapse. But that would require more investigation to better understand.
But the potential is there because the study was done under circumstances that are far from ideal, right?
Far from ideal in that setting. We were all learning and we were building the plane as we were flying in those early days of the pandemic. And this reflects March of 2020 through August of 2020. So really in that early phase when we were all in lockdown and needing to take all sorts of precautions, especially for immunocompromised patients. And there has been data that's come out on the risks of COVID-19 within transplant patients in the post-transplant period, and they are at very high risk for mortality if they do conduct or if they do contract COVID-19, and so good reason not to proceed with transplant when there is a high risk of potential infection and other issues that could complicate the post-transplant course.
So, as I've said earlier, kudos to you and your team and your organization. And all the patients who participated in the study, because, well, COVID-19 was adding risk to medical procedures and interventions. Now, if you look at the overall outcomes, cryopreservation versus fresh grafts, there is a potential for practice-changing strategies, right? One thing that you can now adjust is the way you collect and store and make treatment available to patients. Overall, how beneficial is that going to be?
Just our understanding of the limited risks associated with cryopreserve versus fresh grafts. Yes, I think this is very useful data for the field. It helps guide and counsel patients on the risks that are associated with having to use either a cryopreserved or a fresh graft and what that may mean. Ultimately, the risks are I don't want to diminish the risks. The risks are there, but the risks of not proceeding to transplant likely far outweigh the use of a cryopreserved graft versus a fresh graft. So in desperate times, and a fresh graft is not logistically feasible, that a cryopreserved graft can be a reasonable alternative and lead to long-term remissions in these patients facing these devastating hematological malignancies. So wouldn't want to delay transplant or withhold therapy if a fresh graft wasn't available due to the monumental risks associated with not proceeding to transplant in a timely manner and allowing for these diseases to progress. It has been shown in previous studies going from, say, a first complete remission in, say, acute leukemia and having a relapse or multiple relapses that may be controlled with additional rounds of chemotherapy lead to a further risk associated with proceeding to transplant at a later date. So transplanting in advanced disease versus in early stage diseases can look very different with a much higher risk of mortality once the disease has been allowed to progress beyond a first or second remission. That all those things need to be taken into account. We also use this information to counsel our donors as well, because there is a potential risk that a product would not be used if it is intended for cryopreservation. Although we saw that was relatively low, I believe it was under 3% overall of products that had not been infused, which is not, but still is not zero. And undergoing the actual collection procedure, whether that be a bone marrow harvest or a peripheral blood stem cell apheresis procedure, do come with risks. And so we would want to minimize that for our donors. But we've also surveyed our donors to better understand whether they are willing to tolerate that risk, that their product may not be used in the event that it needed to be cryopreserved. And most are willing, the vast majority are willing to go forward with that procedure and if it could be beneficial to the patient at the end of the day. And so they're willing to take on that risk for those patients.
So overall, with the COVID pandemic, the study shows very positive outcomes, helping you to improve practice and to make treatment available to more patients in need. Now, looking beyond these findings, are there other interesting findings that may impact the future of practice that may benefit patients?
Well, I think just the understanding the underlying risks associated with cryopreservation are important, but we still need to learn more. So we need to understand the longer term implications that may be here. So we've really only looked at 1 year outcomes at this point. So most patients would want to know a bit more, a bit longer term. Their hope would be that this is curative. So we do want to look at, say, 3-5 years post-transplant and see if there are potentially longer term complications that were not taken into account in this particular study. So more work to do on that point. But then that's about it. But then also this interesting finding on reduced risk of chronic GVHD, which it impacts a large portion of patients receiving allogeneic transplant today, upwards of 50%. And so anything that we can, and it's very difficult to treat. So anything that we can do to further reduce the risk of chronic GVHD post-transplant without impacting the durable remission, et cetera, it would be beneficial for patients in the long run. It'll improve quality of life and reduce morbidity and mortality post-transplant. So definitely something that we want to understand a bit more. And maybe there are opportunities for graft manipulation that could be applied in the fresh setting that still leads to that benefit in chronic GVHD reduction without the associated risk with cryopreservation. So more to come there and more opportunities to further explore these data.
Well, I'm looking forward to learning more about this and the results from plant studies and how these outcomes may indeed benefit patients. Dr. Spelman, Steve, thank you so much for joining me in the Oncogene Brief today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you. In this episode of the Oncogene Brief, I spoke with Dr. Steven Spelman. Dr. Spelman is Vice President and Senior Scientific Director at Be the Match and the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research. For more information about becoming a donor, please visit bethematch.org/become-a-donor. For more information about the National Marrow Donor Program, Be the Match and the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research, or CIBMTR, at the Medical College of Wisconsin, go to cibmtr.org. And for more information about the studies presented in this program, please go to our online journal, Oncogene, at oncogene.com. For us here at the Oncogene Brief, we want to thank you, our listeners, sponsors, and advertisers, for your ongoing support. Your support makes it possible that you can hear this program via PRX Public Radio Exchange, and in the United Kingdom and mainland Europe, via UK Health Radio. And starting this month, the Oncogene Brief is also available via Southwest Public Radio. You can also download our program via podcast and streaming media, including iTunes, Spotify, Audible, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and nearly anywhere you can find a podcast. If you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer to 66866, that is 66866, and we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology. And if you like what we do and want to support the Oncogene Brief, visit our website again, oncogene@oncogene.com. You can also find information about how to join as an individual sponsor or as a corporate sponsor or advertiser. Support for the Oncogene Brief comes from the Oncology Directory at oncologydirectory.com and from listeners like you. Thank you all, and thank you for listening. And join us again for our next episode. I'm Peter Hovland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
The Oncogene Brief is a global medical educational service from the publishers of Oncogene and ADC Review, the Journal of Antibody Drug Conjugates. Support for the Oncogene Brief comes from our commercial underwriters and advertisers and the listeners to this station. For more information about advertising, underwriting, and sponsoring options, visit Oncogene at www.oncogene.com/podcasts. The Oncogene Brief contains health and medicine-related information and is provided for educational and entertainment purposes only. The content in this program is not intended as a substitute for professional medical or health advice and does not replace your doctor's advice and guidance. Your doctor is the best person to answer questions about your personal health. If you hear something in this program that doesn't agree with what your doctor has told you, ask him or her about it.